Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Timon of Athens, Act 4. Decline to your confounding contraries, and yet confusion live. Timon sees corruption everywhere, and withdraws to perfect his newfound misanthropy. In Act 4, Scene 1, we are subjected to Timon's first sustained outburst expressing his rage not just at particular foes, but at humankind. As Epimantus will say in Act 4, Scene 3, Timon cannot maintain the middle way in anything but runs to excess both in his generosity and now in his condemnation of all humanity. Quote unquote, the middle of humanity thou never knewest, but the extremity of both ends. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 301 through 302. Timon now sees nothing but knavery everywhere he looks, even in institutions such as law and the conventions that uphold social hierarchy and sexual morality. To all these forces of righteousness and restraint, he offers a harsh prayer, quote unquote, decline to your confounding contraries, and yet confusion live. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 20 through 21. Much of what Timon says here is close in tone, if not ultimately in wisdom, to King Lear's awful insights into the corruption of human nature and the consequent perversion of the stays set up to keep that corruption in check. As Lear says, quote unquote, the usurer hangs the cozener. Through tattered clothes great vices do appear. Robes and furred gowns hide all. Lear, Act 4, Scene 6, lines 157 through 159. In his great book, Walden Pond, one reason that Henry David Thoreau identifies as to why he moved to the woods in the mid-1840s is that he wanted, as he says, quote unquote, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Well, at least that part of Thoreau's mission statement somewhat resembles Timon's raison d'etre from Act 3 onward. If we ask why Timon has gone to the woods, we can gather the most disturbing part of his answer by reading the conclusion to his prayer, quote unquote, the gods confound, hear me, you good gods all, the Athenians both within and out that wall. And grant as Timon grows, his hate may grow to the whole race mankind, high and low. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 37 through 40. Now that's a program not designed to appeal to an upbeat American transcendentalist like Henry David Thoreau. For Timon's sake, let's yet be fellows. Flavius encourages Timon's former servants to show loyalty towards one another as well as their master. In Act 4, Scene 2, Flavius, Timon's former steward, meets with his fellow servants and selflessly shares with these social underlings a portion of his dwindling wealth. He does this to emulate his master's generosity, but in a down-to-earth way, grounded in necessity, not in the grandiose and primarily symbolic manner of Timon. What is Flavius's support for Timon based on? Well, in his soliloquy, he does not mention the Aristotelian golden mean standard for assessing virtue, namely that there's a healthy mean between excess and deficiency. But he seems to be acting on the basis of a standard that we and Shakespeare's audience would recognize. It's the one Portia declares when she tells Shylock in Act 4, Scene 1 of The Merchant of Venice, quote unquote, the quality of mercy is not strained. Compassion should come naturally and be extended as many times as necessary. Portia's approach is not much different from Christ's answer to Peter in Matthew 18, 21 through 22, when the apostle asked how many times he should forgive a brother. Quote unquote, I say not to thee unto seven times, but unto 70 times seven times. That's the Geneva Bible, BibleGateway.com. Flavius takes no personal offense at his old master's mistakes and shallowness, but forgives him. It's unfortunate that Timon doesn't return the sentiment, but Flavius remains loyal just the same. This same Christian point, namely, that the exercise of virtues matters even when it doesn't gratify the exerciser, is on display in The Tempest, too. Prospero forgives Alonso, Antonio, and Sebastian all alike for their offenses against him, but only Alonso shows remorse. No matter, for as Prospero himself says, quote unquote, "The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 25 through 28. Hate all, curse all, show charity to none. Many visitors file by Timon's hut in the wilderness, some for the gold he has just discovered while digging for roots, only to be battered with scorn and derision. In Act 4, Scene 3, again sounding like King Lear in the depths of his fury, Timon curses all human pretensions to anything better than vice and wickedness. Who, he asks, can honestly, quote-unquote, "stand upright and say, this man's a flatterer. If one be, so are they all, for every grease of fortune is smoothed by that below." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 14 through 17. Everything is governed by a furious, if spurious, addiction to hierarchy and advantage-taking. All Timon wants from Mother Earth now is edible roots, but in the strangest of coincidences, if such it is, while digging for his next meal, he finds a large quantity of gold, perhaps in the form of coins. At the moment, Timon can only reckon up the many bad effects of the precious yellow metal. He reburies some of it, but leaves a portion exposed, as he says, "for earnest," quote unquote. A drum announces the entrance of Captain Alcibiades with his soldiers and two prostitutes, Phrynia and Timandra. These are the first among his many visitors in Act 4, Scene 3. Initially, Timon curses at Alcibiades and tells him to betake his interest in gold elsewhere. But when the captain offers him gold, he rejects it and offers him some in return, encouraging him to destroy Athens and show no pity for even the most innocent. Quote unquote, "Put armor on thine ears and on thine eyes, whose proof nor yells of mothers, maids, nor babes, nor sight of priests in holy vestments bleeding shall pierce a jot." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 124 through 127. Or as Mark Antony would say, "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war," quote unquote. Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 1, line 275. As for the prostitutes, Phrynia and Timandra, Timon is obsessively positive about the world's oldest profession that they follow. Perhaps that's so because prostitution turns an otherwise generous, beneficial passion into an engine of destruction against humankind. He showers Phrynia and Timandra with gold to extract a promise that they will not leave off afflicting Athenian men, along with those the men inadvertently harm, with STIs. As Timon puts it, what the prostitutes can inflict on Athens is far worse than anything Alcibiades and his soldiers plan to do. Quote unquote, "Be whores still," he tells them, quote unquote, "and he whose pious breath seeks to convert you, be strong in whore, allure him, burn him up." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 140 through 142. Next to visit Timon in Act 4, Scene 3, is Apamantus, our favorite Cynic philosopher, and the two men have quite a back and forth. Apamantus's first gesture is to try to deflate what he takes to be Timon's continued ego and arrogance by insisting that this one-time rich lord has come by his cynicism at cut rate. Quote unquote, "This is in thee," he taunts Timon, quote unquote, "a nature but infected, a poor unmanly melancholy sprung from change of future. Why this spade, this place, this slave-like habit and these looks of care. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 203 through 206. Timon listens to more of such talk and then turns the argument around against Apamantus, saying, quote-unquote, "Thou art a slave whom fortune's tender arm with favor never clasped, but bred a dog." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 251 through 252. Timon goes on to suggest that if this cynic born to misery had a rich person's upbringing, he would have thrown himself into a state of, quote-unquote, general riot and depravity, just like any spoiled rich brat. Act 4, Scene 3, line 257. Quote unquote, "If thou hadst not been born the worst of men, thou hadst been a knave and flatterer." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 276 through 277. Apamantus responds to Timon's question about what he would do if he could do anything he wanted as follows. He would hand over the earth to wild animals, quote unquote, to be rid of the men. Act 4, Scene 3, line 322. This logic Timon rejects utterly, calling it, quote unquote, "a beastly ambition to wish that men were no better than beasts." Act 4, Scene 3, line 326. What he appears to mean is that he sees no advantage in living in a primal state. In such a state, there obtains, as Thomas Hobbes would later write in Leviathan, about life before civil contracts, nothing but a universal, quote unquote, "war of everyone against everyone." In such a condition, Timon says, there really is no freedom since, as he asks, quote unquote, "what beast couldst thou be that were not subject to a beast? And what a beast art thou already that seest not thy loss in transformation?" Act 4, Scene 3, lines 340 through 342. This is, in its way, as unanswerable as King Lear's refusal to accept his proposed reduction by Regan and Goneril to living in accordance with mere necessity, without his 100 retainers. Quote unquote, "Oh, reason not the need," thundered the old king. States of unadorned necessity or unaccommodated nature never seem to have appealed much to Shakespeare. Apamantus and Timon nearly come to blows, and strangely, Timon advances a confession that largely undoes what he had said by way of distinguishing between men and beasts. He tells Apamantus, quote unquote, "I am sick of this false world and will love naught but even the mere necessities upon it." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 369 through 370. His parting words to the cynic amount to a paean to the destructive power of gold, and in turn, Apamantus promises to tell the Athenians that Timon has gold so that they will pester him for it. Timon's next greeters in Act 4, Scene 3 are three bandits who delicately call themselves, quote unquote, "men that much do want." Act 4, Scene 3, line 408. No matter, Timon gives them gold and encourages them to go about their trade. He even offers a litany explaining how practically everything, including the sun and the moon and the sea, is really a thief if you consider its operation. The men that much do want, so-called, don't know what to make of Timon, so off they go. Timon's final visitor in Act 4, Scene 3, is his loyal steward Flavius, who has come to check up on his old boss. Upon seeing Timon, Flavius exclaims, quote unquote, "O monument and wonder of good deeds evilly bestowed." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 453 through 454. Timon's generosity was right, implies the steward. He just lavished it on the wrong people. But he also questions the very concept of friendship, saying, quote unquote, "what viler thing upon the earth than friends who can bring noblest minds to basest ends?" Act 4, Scene 3, lines 456 through 457. In a corrupt society, how can such a concept as friendship survive? Conversing with Flavius, Timon finds himself compelled to admit that the corruption of the world is not quite universal. Quote unquote, I do proclaim one honest man, mistake me not, but one. No more, I pray, and he's a steward. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 488 through 490. This sounds almost like damning with faint praise, or snobbery, but at least Timon seems sincere in it. What are we to make of Timon's parting gesture of offering Flavius gold, that horrible metal that he's already said has corrupted the world? Well, he gives this gift, so-called, with one strong injunction. Quote-unquote, hate all, curse all, show charity to none, but let the famished flesh slide from the bone ere thou relieve the beggar. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 519 through 521. Impervious to Flavius's prayer to let him stay, Timon sends this one good man on his way, and there ends the long procession of people whom Timon would rather not have encountered. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Saturday, June 21st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare's third edition, four-volume, genre-based format.